Welcome to River Talk, the podcast that talks about everything river-related, hosted by Zach Collier, Eric Wyseth, and me, Priscilla Macy. Today, we'll be talking about some of the recent events that have been happening in the paddling community, give a little recap, and we're going to talk a little bit about festival culture as it pertains to paddling. Do you have any news of the week, Zach?
Well, I think the big news is what Senator Wyden announced yesterday for the 51st anniversary of the Wildland Scenic Rivers Act. And I know you know a lot about it. You're probably in a meeting this week for it. But he basically wants input from Oregonians on what rivers should be designated Wildland Scenic next.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Yeah. So right now he and other organizations posted basically an open call to nominate a river that you think deserves protecting. So you can pretty much nominate whatever you want. Obviously, there are limitations as to what rivers can actually end up being designated. So like ones that are surrounded by private property probably won't be the best candidate, but ones that you think need protecting from future development, need protecting for clean water, for recreation, those are all good candidates. And next week, American Whitewater will be launching a every action form. So if you don't want to spend time thinking too much and writing a letter and sending it yourself, then American Whitewater will let you know which ones we think are important for protecting because of their whitewater recreation value.
Yeah, and I think there's some important things when you nominate a river. First of all, if it's already wild and scenic, it doesn't need to be nominated. And a bunch of people, Wyden put up a post on Facebook, you know, tell me your favorite river, what should be protected? And there was a lot of Rogue, a lot of Illinois, a lot of Mackenzie and Umpqua. And we already have 68 wild and scenic designations in Oregon. There's tons out there. So first of all, before you nominate one, make sure it's already not a wild and scenic river. Because you can't be a wild and scenic. It doesn't like add up. It's not twice the protection.
And you can go to rivers.gov and whatever state you live in, click on the interactive map and it'll show you what rivers are already protected and what segments of those rivers are already protected. So something you could suggest, like for example, on the Rogue, the upper Rogue, there's parts of that or the Middle Fork Rogue. Those aren't protected under the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. So if there's a specific segment that isn't protected according to the map that you can look at rivers.gov, then you can suggest that. But yeah, don't go nominating ones that are already protected because you'll just spend a bunch of time suggesting something that's, that you don't need to.
Yep. And this is just for Oregon, right? So there's no point in suggesting them in Washington.
Yeah. Yes,
so,
yes.
So there's, I think it's rivers.gov/oregon.php or something. We'll put a link in the show notes in the website to that. I have a website, oregonwildandscenic.com, that lists all of Oregon's wild and scenic rivers with information about them too.
So and I'll include some of the ones that were more recently protected that might not, they may have not updated on rivers.gov yet.
I haven't updated my site either, but I will get on that.
Okay.
And an important thing that you mentioned, Priscilla, I just want to reiterate, is that a wild and scenic river protection doesn't typically protect the entire river. It's typically a segment, like 5 miles, 10 miles, 100 miles. I think it's only like five total designations are the entire river from top to bottom. And so your favorite river, like the Illinois, for example, only the bottom, I think, 50 miles are protected. But there's a bunch of rivers upstream, a bunch of tributaries upstream in Illinois River that haven't been protected.
Yeah, and so there's a few other just basic requirements for it to be potentially eligible for designation. So the segment has to be free flowing. So a good example is there's a segment of the North Umpqua River in Southwest Oregon that is protected under wild and scenic, but upstream isn't because there's hydropower facility. So it has to be free flowing. And then it has to have outstandingly remarkable values. And so those could be ecological, scenic, recreational. So when you're nominating a river, try to think of why that river stands out from other rivers in the area and what those outstanding values might be. So if you're planning on sending a letter in just on by yourself, I would recommend going to rivers.gov. And if you're not already familiar with what the requirements are for them to be eligible, go give that a look, or go to Zach's website or American Rivers website or American Whitewater. Those websites have quick summaries on what the requirements are for eligibility, and that'll help you, filter out your list of rivers.
Yeah, definitely. The outstandingly remarkable value, or the ORV, is an important part, and it's incredibly vague. It talks about them being scenic, recreational, geological, a few other things in the bill, and then there's other. So right. As long as it's outstanding for some reason, you're only going to nominate it if it's outstanding anyway. You're not going to, nominate some flat section of river with a bunch of broken cars next to it. For me, the place that I care about the most right now in protecting is the area around the Kalmiopsis. And, the main Illinois River and Chetka Rivers are protected, but there's tons of tributaries of the Illinois that haven't been protected and definitely could use that protection. So I'm going to start pushing hard to protect those rivers down there.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, if you don't want to spend a bunch of time thinking about how to draft a letter, or you just, don't have the time or don't feel like you have the expertise, American Whitewater next week, we're planning to launch an easy fill form that will suggest the rivers that we've identified as ones that either have threats or just generally need to be protected and have whitewater values to them. So keep an eye out for that.
What are some of those rivers, Priscilla? There's some that you can mention now that you think are particularly important for American Whitewater?
So a couple that would be recognizable are, like you were saying, the Illinois area. Just in general, that drainage is really important to not only recreation, but clean water and protecting from potential threats from mining claims and commercial mining. So that'll be one of the focuses, and we'll identify the tributaries of the Illinois that have been kayaked and, show some pictures of that or video of that. And then another segment that we are looking at are tributaries to the North Santiam and the South Santiam. So like the Brighton Bush River, for example, which is a beautiful river. And then another one that we've talked about is the segment on the White River, which has Celestial Falls.
Oh, yeah.
So that would be Tom O'Keefe says that's his number one priority, because the reason it wasn't designated is because there was a hydropower proposal. And obviously we want to protect the free flowing nature of that segment of river. So this would be one of the tools to accomplish that and make sure that it doesn't get developed in the future.
And that one's a slam dunk too. That the White River is an example of it being entirely protected from its headwaters in Mount Hood. All the way to the Deschutes, except for that one, except like half a mile section. Yeah, it's like not even half a mile. And that would completely protect the entire White as wild and scenic. Yeah. And going back to the Santiam, do you know that Opal Creek is not wild and scenic?
Yeah, I did. But so I talked to someone, I actually suggested it, and they're like, well, it's surrounded by the wilderness area. Yeah. So that is a complementary protection where designating it as wild and scenic doesn't necessarily accomplish that much. So, I guess something that would help that river though, if you wanted to protect it further, would be like the state scenic waterways, because that does something that the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act doesn't do, which is it helps protect against any future withdrawals of groundwater supply that feed the stream. So I learned that recently, that there's, one specific thing that the State Scenic Waterways Act does, and it helps protect under groundwater withdrawals in a drainage area. So if that was ever a threat, that might be something to pursue. But the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act wouldn't really accomplish that much, since it's surrounded by the designated wilderness area.
And that's a good point, that wilderness protection is better than wildland scenic river protection. It's more, you know, once it's protected as wilderness, it's highly protected. It is possible to dam in wilderness. There's some loophole in the Wilderness Act that wildland scenic rivers protect from. That's the one additional thing. But
yeah,
creating a dam in a wilderness area is tough, so it's not a real threat.
Yeah.
But I do know that one of the reasons Senator Wyden wants to do this is that he wants to have more wildland scenic river miles than Alaska. I think he's motivated. We have more designations by far than any other state, but he now wants miles. And I think we're behind Alaska by, like, I think it's like 800 or 1,000 miles.
Yeah.
Something like that. It's a lot because Alaska has big, long rivers that they designated. But it seems like to reach that goal, Opal Creek is a slam dunk. Like, nobody's going to oppose it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not sure why that suggestion wasn't being pursued specifically, but maybe once all the suggestions roll in, they'll evaluate everything. And if that one is on the list of just suitable slam dunk, then I'm sure they'll add it in there. But
yeah,
I think for AW, they're just focusing on the rivers that have some sort of threat, you know?
Okay.
So trying to protect the rivers now when we have this incredible opportunity to, because going through the other processes that you can designate are obviously longer and a bit more bureaucratic.
So are there other rivers out there that AW is looking at? You mentioned the stuff around the Illinois, the stuff around the Santiam, anything else in particular?
We talked about the Forks of the Rogue, which may be a little bit challenging because there is some private property intersecting those segments, but we talked about at least nominating them. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I don't have the list right in front of me right now, but there was a handful of rivers / drainages that we were considering to have in terms of suggesting to members that they should nominate them because of their recreation value in terms of whitewater. Yeah. So
super cool.
That'll be coming out next week. So keep your eye out.
Yeah. And the biggest thing, if anybody wants to do anything right now, is thank Senator Wyden. You know, send him a tweet, send him a letter, you know, post on Facebook.
Repost this thing from wherever you saw it. Yeah, that'd be really helpful. And help get people aware of the nomination process and maybe send in some creative ideas.
Yep. Yep. But this week is especially timely to thank him because he's always putting himself out on a limb a little bit like this. And he needs to show that we're appreciative and he has voters and people to vote for him that are appreciative. So taking a minute to thank him in some way would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see what other things happened recently. We had the Chelan release and Feather River Festival. Both were awesome. The Chelan, that was my first time, and I would say you definitely need to have a class 5 skill set to do the release. And I would say some of the run out is maybe some of the more hazardous rapids on the run. They're actually, so you can portage most of the rapids, but there was one that wasn't really feasible to portage. And I would call it a class 5 rapid. So I wouldn't send anyone that was a, enthusiastic class 4 boater in there.
All right, I'll stay out.
Someone did R1 it though, which was pretty impressive. He said it was maybe the most physically difficult thing for him to do because the boulder gardens and the gravel bars at the end of the run that go on for, I don't know, less than a mile, but long enough to be difficult to carry by yourself a 13-foot raft over boulders. So he said it was fun, but he's probably going to bring his kayak next time.
Yeah, that's pretty cool that somebody who has the ability to R1 and kayak at that level.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, this guy is very motivated and doesn't shy away from any type of craft to get down a river.
Yeah, I love that. I'm a big fan of being able to choose the craft based on where you're going.
Me too. Me too. And then Featherfest, we were both at that.
Yeah, it's cool.
Zach
cool
won the IK
you.
Class, which is awesome. I didn't bring my IK.
I won the raft, the R2 with Aaron Babcock and the
right.
IK. I swam in both races. In the exact same spot, both races, and still was able to pull it off.
Dang. Yeah. Well, nice work.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's an awesome event, and lots of all different types of people show up, and it's a great gathering of river people before the rainy season starts.
Yeah, I was shocked how many people were there. That was unbelievable. And from all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, international people as well, not just people from the U.S. So really popular event, and lots of rivers in that area to enjoy if they're releasing or if flows allow. So,
well, one thing I thought about a lot when I went this year was like the culture of festivals. And I feel like it wasn't very long ago that festivals, you know, were things that happened that weren't that popular. Mm. And as I was, you know, it was like Clackfest. I was one of the organizers of Clackfest for a while. And I feel like we were always trying to figure out how to get more people there. It was always an issue. Mm-hmm. Like, how do we attract more people? How do we pay the bills? Yeah. And now when I was sitting around the campfire that one night when I saw you. And, you know, there were people there like, oh, I'm going to 4 festivals next year. There were people at Gollyfest the previous weekend. And it seems like now there's a culture of people that boating is mainly about festivals, or that's a huge part of it, which is pretty cool. But it's new to me. Like I'm pretty, you know, the festival is something I always like, oh, if I have time, I'll go to the festival. If I have a weekend, there's nothing going on.
Yeah.
Where now the festivals seem like a mainstay of boating culture for a lot of people.
Yeah. I think it's a part of the growth of the sport. And it's also a place where I see a lot of fellow paddlers bringing their family members or, you know, girlfriends or wives or friends that don't boat or occasionally boat to these events, which I think, you know, in our sport, it's not the most conducive to having friends that don't paddle or significant others hang out with us because they have to sit in a car for, you know, half a day wondering if we're okay and then pick us up at the end. So festivals are a really fun way for us to showcase our sport to other people that we care about in the community. And it's also a way for, I feel like festivals are rare events where a lot of us that don't see each other, that paddle together, only paddle together during those type of events or releases, just because everyone is, you know, chasing their own list of rivers they want to do or training for whatever thing that they want to do next. So festivals are kind of brings everyone of all different types of paddling ability, and, you know, whether you're someone that likes doing off the beaten path rivers or you're someone that's just breaking into Class 4, I feel like it's one of those events where you can see all your friends and hang out and, you know, drink beer together and eat some food together, camp out and have a good time.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating to me because I enjoy going to them when I can, but I just couldn't believe how many people this is. It almost seems like they're mainly into whitewater because of the festivals.
Yeah,
that the festival circuit is a fun way to. It's like racquetball tournaments. You know, I used to play racquetball, and then like, oh, let's go to a racquetball tournament. It's sort of like that, a gathering of people, and you know, there's some winners.
Yeah, it certainly seems like there is a core group of people that, you know, whether it's for trying to win the most races or just enter the most races or hang out, seems like there's a number of core groups of people that tend to be at a majority of the festivals.
Yeah. The one thing somebody brought to me last week, that he went to Gollyfest and he was really concerned about the drinking and the partying and just the safety on the river. And that's a concern of mine as this grows, that people are going for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. I felt like Featherfest was pretty chill. Like I didn't think that drinking was out of hand, or I didn't, you know, I wasn't everywhere all the time, but I felt like it was pretty straightforward.
Yeah. It was pretty funny. I was talking to a paddler colleague of mine who went to Gali, and he said that a group of them were talking about the difference between Featherfest and Gollyfest, having both been there, or just West Coast festivals versus East Coast festivals. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know what the difference is? Everyone on the West Coast, it's legal to smoke pot. So there's not a lot of just crazy drunken shenanigans going on because everyone goes to bed earlier, drinks less, and is just generally more relaxed. And I said, that is a hilarious observation. but he was saying at Gali, just, you know, the drinking is out of control. And obviously it's a much older festival, and there's a lot of people that attend it that don't paddle. But he was saying there is a heavy amount of drinking that goes on there, and he didn't notice the same type of behavior at some of the West Coast festivals. It was much more laid back.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was super impressed. And I mean, as I'm getting older, I feel like a fuddy duddy. You know, I'm like, hey guys, like tone the drinking down, or if you go paddling, make sure you're safe. I'm one of those guys now. And, and I just want to make sure that I just worry that the festival culture will start growing into more of a huge party and be more about the drinking than the boating or the river.
Yeah. I think depending on where the festival takes place, like the difficulty of the river will kind of censor that. Cause yeah. I think, you know, people don't want to, you know, end up in a bad position, on purpose on a difficult river. And it seems like I've never been to the Gauley, so you can correct me. I don't know if you've been, but it seems like there's segments of river where you don't really have to have skill to navigate, and it kind of encourages people to go down it during that weekend. So maybe that's part of some of the concern or rising concern about it. And I feel like most of the festivals I've been to on the West Coast, it just seems like the difficulty of the run filters out people that have drank too much. So they're just like, I don't want to be boating right now. I should probably hang out at camp for a while.
Yeah. I think on the Gauley, things are pretty challenging. Like even it's like at least class three, the new is probably class three. The lower Gauley is like easy four, maybe 3+. And the upper is like 4+ or, you know, maybe 5.
And I guess there's rafting. So you can just throw a bunch of people in a raft and they don't feel as worried, I suppose. So that might be part of it.
Yeah, where the Feather, I mean, I guess there's that Rock Creek section's a little easier, but it's generally pretty, I mean, the rapids are pretty serious. You know, it's a little bit civvy and depending on where you go. And the Tobin section
is definitely serious. And some people had some carnage over this last weekend that was a little bit scary. So, I think overall, I've never really had a bad experience at any festivals thus far, but I could see concern of them growing so big that you're having a lot of outsiders participate in them that aren't a part of the boating community and might want to take advantage of, the friendliness of the kayaking community and the trusting part of them, like what we've had happen for a couple years at the Northwest Creeking Competition. You have people that basically go in there and steal stuff because they know that kayakers just leave their boats around or their gear around. And so I think for me, that's one of the bigger concerns for the festivals. It's not the people that are within our community or the close people that we bring into the community. It's outsiders that realize there's this festival going on and everyone just leaves their stuff unlocked and their boats laying out and starts preying on that, I suppose.
Well, I'm super grateful for the people who put them together. It's a ton of work, and it's sometimes thankless. And the organizers have to deal with sort of the bad things, the people that aren't happy about something, it's not always like a big celebration for the organizers. So I'm super grateful of the people that organize these events. And I don't know, who organized Featherfest?
Chico Paddleheads and American Whitewater. But Chico Paddleheads were the ones who started it.
Cool.
So they're certainly the ones to thank, and they're a very active paddle club, and all the people that helped out with the event. I just like the guys serving beer were awesome. And I was like, thank you guys so much. This is such a great event. Yeah. I get to enjoy. And, you know, American Whitewater sold tickets to the event. So they had a bunch of staff and volunteers helping manage the event as well. So yeah, they do a great job every year, and they showed some awesome films the first night. I think it's having organized much smaller paddling events, knowing how much effort it is just to get insurance, to get people to show up and all those sorts of things. It's incredible that most of our events are totally organized by volunteers or small paddle clubs or small nonprofits.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're pretty much done. This is it, right? There's no more festivals till the spring.
Yeah. I think we're done. At least. Yeah. I'm pretty sure in the U.S. we're done with festivals until kind of the season starts.
Yeah, maybe the Wind Festival will be the first one in March.
Yeah, hope so. Yeah. Be fun to have that one again.
I really want to have a Hood River Festival.
That'd be awesome.
I'm not going to be the one that organizes it. But it's just such, like, it's, I love it. It's just like a fun class three run, come out here, have people camp, and it'd be fun to have a Hood River Festival someday. So if anybody's looking for a project, wants a thankless, a thankless job, we have a great river here in our backyard to have a festival and a great community. And the thing I like about festivals is they can be kind of small, like the Wind, where, you know, people don't really even, I guess some people camp there, but, you know, the Wind can sometimes be like 50, 100 people. To things like Clackfest or Featherfest or Golly Fest, which are hundreds and even thousands of people.
Yeah.
Like, there's huge diversity in the festival world.
Definitely.
So. Cool. Well, you want to go into Gear of the Week?
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess we can call this like a little mini episode. We'll hopefully try to do more of these so that we can get more content out.
I think we're way more likely to do them on a regular basis if they're shorter.
Yes, I totally agree. So we'll try to make a habit of doing more mini-sodes.
Yeah.
See, my gear of the week, Jacob and I just got an electric battery chainsaw. It's one of the higher-end ones. It was a present from a family for Jacob's birthday. And we tested it out on some trees in our backyard. And it's awesome. It's super, I was impressed with how much power it had. I just had this perception in my head that electric or battery operated chainsaws, weren't even close to comparable to the gas powered ones. And, pretty excited to take it out and chop some more firewood.
Okay. Is this for firewood or is this for putting in your car?
I would say we're going to put it in our car so that when we're on, you know, a gravel road in the middle of nowhere and there's a tree that fell down, like, you know, we've been there where it's like, oh, handsaws aren't going to do the trick. And then you just have to forego doing the trip. So I think this will be something that we keep in the back of the car to not get thwarted as much.
What brand is it?
Oh, shoot. Why don't you go into your gear of the week and I'll go look at the brand and then I'll come back.
So, I mean, that's okay. I'll just put in the show notes.
Okay.
My gear of the week is similar. It's a Makita hand blower pump. That's an electric pump that I now use to blow my wraps up.
Is it cordless?
It's cordless. It just uses the same battery as a cordless drill. And I put that and a couple of batteries in my truck when I go to put in, and I can pump up 5 or 10 wraps with it. So
that's
mine plus a few others. And it sucks the air out when you're done.
Nice.
So this battery powered stuff is a future. And if you go, I want to ask the brand because I have Steel chainsaws. I think that's how you pronounce it. Steel.
Steel? Steel? I always call it Steel, but I don't know
Steel.
If that's right.
I don't know. My dad had that kind, so that's just what I buy. And I go to the shop and they're starting to have a much bigger electric tool section.
Yeah. Well, what's awesome is there's no maintenance.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, small motors are just a nightmare.
Yeah.
No matter how high quality they are, like, you put them through a lot and then eventually something fails and you can't figure out what it is and you spend all your time sending it to mechanics and then you just have to buy a new one. But from what we've read and watched and researched, it sounds like the electric ones just have zero maintenance. Like, maybe you'll have to replace the battery at some point, just refill it with bar oil and good to go.
Yep.
So I love that. Especially for someone that already has to like manage old cars and our motorized bicycle, and you know, we're always trying to fix gear. There's always a long list of stuff that we have to be fixing.
kind
of feels like an outfitting service sometimes.
Yeah, I this last week my luggage and my computer broke.
No,
so it's just a hassle to deal with both. But anyway, nobody cares about that. So yeah, I'll put links to your chainsaw and my Makita blower thing in the show notes on the website if anybody wants to check them out.
Yeah. Well, I think that's it for our little mini podcast. We'll try to get on next week with the rest of the team or do another mini one.